Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Regina. And I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop focuses upon metastatic prostate cancer. And we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. And we have on the call today over 300 participants. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from many different parts of the world. And we also have a number of participants from other countries as well. And it's just a pleasure to have all of you on the call today. Now, I just want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program. And we are delighted to have you all on the call. And I am now going to introduce, I'm going to actually introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin will introduce herself.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. And hello, everyone. My name is Susan Slovin. I am an attending physician at the Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers over at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and also professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College. I'm always pleased to join Dr. Messner in trying to bring you updates with regard to treating prostate cancer, and today is going to be focused on metastatic prostate cancer. It's interesting because you can't expect to have a new drug every year, but what we are now learning is that for some of the drugs that are already out there, we're finding new ways of using them, and we're also doing a lot more research trying to identify features that may put patients at particular risk for other types of disease within the prostate armamentarium, so to speak. And what we're talking about is the risk of different appearing prostate cancers called neuroendocrine. I'll touch upon that very, very briefly shortly. So a lot of what we've learned right now is that there's no less right now than probably seven different treatments given along with hormonal therapy for patients who have brand new metastatic prostate cancer who have not even started hormonal therapy. As everybody knows, the center of treating a patient is to use either a pill or an injection that stops the brain from sending a signal to the gonads to make the male hormone testosterone. And that comes in different forms, as everyone I'm sure knows. Well, if you have metastatic disease that's never been treated, the standard of care has been the use of a hormone injection or a hormone pill, but also there has been a class of agents called androgen receptor signaling inhibitors, and they go by a variety of different names, from enzalutamide to apalutamide to abiraterone, and more recently, of course, was the introduction of a chemotherapy docetaxel along with hormonal therapy. Now, that seems like a lot, but we've learned over the last few years of what we call a treatment intensification approach, meaning that we can add one of these hormonal androgen receptor blocking agents to chemotherapy with docetaxel and the hormone injection. And it has been proven to be beneficial, particularly in patients for whom we feel that just giving the combination of the hormone injection and the pill is insufficient. And we have approval by the FDA for using a combination of either a pill called darolutamide along with docetaxel and the hormone injection, or abiraterone with docetaxel and the hormonal injection. Now, why is this interesting? Because just recent data has come out that we can now use darolutamide along with hormonal injection alone, as opposed to combining it in this particular type of presentation, as opposed to using it in combination with chemotherapy. So this is yet another one. It's probably treatment number 8 in the long list of treatments for patients with hormone-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer. In addition to this, now almost probably will be approved based on what we call the ARANOTE, A-R-A-N-O-T-E trial. And again, this is just as beneficial as abiraterone or docetaxel or the other drugs that are out there. But we are now learning that when patients are diagnosed, we want to know about how aggressive is the cancer. Of course, we can look under the microscope and see certain features, what we call patterns that might influence a cancer's behavior. The patterns under the microscope are often called acinar, A-C-I-N-A-R, or cribriform, or intraductal, which we don't use it all the time in terms of diagnosis, but the pathologist makes note of it because those types of patterns, when you see them under the microscope, may lend the cancer to behave perhaps a little bit more aggressively, such that the cancer, even if it's intermediate, such as a Gleason 7, might end up behaving more like a Gleason 8. So we always want to know about that. But what patients often want to know, as do doctors, is, gee, how aggressive, aside from the pathology, is there cancer? What's the likelihood that my disease may ultimately spread? And so this is really something that the urologists have had in their bandwidth for many, many years, called the Decipher score, which is a 22-gene panel, and is able to really apprise us based on the score whether or not the patient has low risk of their disease progressing within 10 years, intermediate risk, or high risk. And it's based on a scoring system where low score would be 0.45 or less, intermediate between 0.45 and 0.6, or high, anything greater than 0.6. This is a very high discriminatory test, so it's helpful to the urologist in trying to make a discussion about whether or not somebody should go forward with surgery. But more recently, at one of the presentations in Europe called ESMO, we're now at the level of being the medical oncologist as opposed to the urologist, thinking that maybe the Decipher score could help in identifying those patients who are newly diagnosed with prostate cancer and may benefit from chemotherapy. And could we extrapolate this to patients who, you know, could we treat them sooner rather than later? So more to come on that, but certainly new application and determining whether or not, you know, tumor burden, how much disease you have, could also be affected by this number. More importantly is that as patients continue to receive treatment, their cancer can change, and I mentioned that a few minutes ago, to indicate that the formation of a different histologic type under the microscope called neuroendocrine prostate cancer, and it has a kind of resemblance to small cell cancer of the lung, although it is not from the lung. It's its own entity, but it can emerge either at diagnosis, meaning just de novo, just came out of nowhere, or it could be if somebody's been on a very long series of treatments. Well, there is a marker that's associated called DLL3, delta-like ligand, for which a new treatment called tarlatamab is being used. It's an antibody drug conjugate. It's been in phase 1 trials. It hasn't gone on to phase 2 yet, as far as I know, but this may offer an alternative treatment to the standard of care that we have used for many, many years, which has been chemotherapy with drugs called cisplatin and etoposide. So what has been going on in the world of prostate is looking for cell surface markers for which we can actually target therapy. And that includes antibody drug conjugates, bispecific T effector cells, or what we call chimeric antibody receptor cells, CAR T cells. I mean, all of those are targeted therapies, but perhaps I think most people in the audience would recognize that PSMA, prostate-specific membrane antigen, has been the most commonly cited target, not only for its use in PET imaging, but also for what we call radioligand study. So lutetium, which is a beta emitter, has deep penetration, has been attached to the PSMA small molecule and has been used not only for PET imaging, but also for treatment. It's a way of bringing radiation into the cell to have an anti-tumor effect, and there's a tremendous amount of benefit. However, people are now looking, and this is in clinical trial, of actinium-225, which is an alpha emitter, very high energy, very short half-life, meaning it doesn't sit in the system for the same time as the lutetium, which is about 6 days. So you sort of hit something hard and very fast, and it gets out of the system. So I would tell you that while we do have lutetium, 177 PSMA, that this is the treatment with actinium is now being looked upon in clinical trial. And not that it's going to be better, but maybe it has lesser toxicities hematologically than what would be seen with the lutetium. We are also looking at diverse populations, trying to determine if there are changes in response patterns for certain groups of patients based on their genetic or ethnic profiles. I would say right now that we are now looking just about at every patient who is newly diagnosed at their genomic profiling. In particular, we're looking for patterns of the BRCA gene, BRCA1 and BRCA2, known as the breast cancer gene. About 40% of men will have BRCA2, and this is important because it will, at some point in your cancer journey, be used as an identification for a treatment with something known as a PARP, P-A-R-P inhibitor. There's a lot that is going on. It's very hard to focus on just one area, but clearly, you know, clinical trials are ongoing, and we have so many new things in clinical trial that it's always important to talk to your doctor about it. What about taking care of bone? Well, we still talk about using zoledronic acid or using denosumab, particularly if patients already have a predilection toward osteopenia or osteoporosis. So that is something that either your medical oncologist or your primary care doctor should be aware of, and at least do what we call a bone mineral density test at least once a year. However, for people who are more symptomatic, we can still use radium-223, which is a radioactive compound that's given once a month intravenously for a total of 6 treatments that is specifically meant for pain control, but not necessarily will reduce your PSA. But what about everything else that's out there? How do we manage the side effects? When people are newly diagnosed, they feel great. And what we often recommend is that people should really get linked in with palliative care very early on, not because you're going to die, but because it's good to have a lot of services available to you, such that if you do have any problems that come up, you're hooked up to a whole network of people. And in particular, the side effects that we all know about is fatigue, pain, weight gain, and all of these things can be addressed. There are now exercise programs. We work with the pain service. I mean, some people have very bad arthritis, and we often think that this is due to their, you know, cancer. It's not. But you can use an anesthesia pain physician to help with injections of steroids or any sort of medication that could help pain that is benign improve. And a lot of patients have chronic back pain from discs and the like. In general, everybody should be evaluated very thoroughly when they walk through the door. They should be genomically profiled, whether you're newly diagnosed or you have a family history. Remember, having a father with prostate gives you a twofold risk. If there's a father and a grandfather, that son of that father is going to have an eightfold risk. So it's very important that we keep up to date and ask your doctor about any new updates that might be reasonable. I always tell patients that if I had something new, I would share it with them. But it's nothing wrong with asking your doctor for any updates that might be relevant to you or even clinical trials. I'm sorry I have such a short time here and I can't regale you with more, but thank you so much for listening. And back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Sullivan. That was just a wonderful, just a very comprehensive presentation. And I know that we talked to you during the Q&A, so I really want to thank you so much for this excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Gorevitz, and I'm going to let Dr. Gorevitz introduce himself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Daniel Gorevitz. I'm a radiation oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and I specialize in treating localized and metastatic prostate cancer. So first question is, what is a radiation oncologist? And a radiation oncologist is a physician that specializes in treating cancer with radiation. We see patients in consultation and determine whether radiation would be beneficial or not. And once we've decided that radiation is indicated, we decide how to deliver it in an effective and safe way. We then design the radiation to really maximize the treatment to the cancer, but also to minimize exposure to surrounding normal tissues. We then oversee the delivery of the treatment and see patients during their treatment course to assess for a response and manage any possible side effects that might come up. After a patient completes their course of radiation, we then see them in follow-up to make sure our treatments continue to work and to help manage any new problems if or when they might arise. So what types of radiation treatments are there? Well, there are many, many, many different types of radiation, and unfortunately it would take me much longer than we have today to explain all these different types in detail, but from a 30,000-foot view, we have external beam radiation, which is typically delivered from machines called linear accelerators. We also have internal radiation, which is called brachytherapy, which is most often done with radioactive seed implants. And lastly, we have injectable forms of radiation, which Dr. Sloven touched upon, that can be injected into a patient and travel around the body to seek out cancer cells in the bone or elsewhere and deposit radiation directly in and around those cancer cells. And these are more broadly known as radiopharmaceuticals. What type of radiation treatment is used for bone metastases? When we give radiation for bone metastases, it's generally delivered using external beam radiation in 1 to 5 total sessions, delivered as an outpatient, and it's unlikely to cause side effects. Radiation treatment for bone metastases can have several goals. The most common is for pain relief or to help patients cut down or stop using pain medications. We also use radiation to prevent impending bone fractures, also to prevent and treat spinal cord compression or nerve compression from bone metastases. A newer indication for radiation is when someone has only a few metastatic lesions, and even if they're asymptomatic from those lesions, we can target their metastases with radiation and delay starting cancer drugs like hormone therapy. Also, if someone is already on hormone therapy, but a few sites are showing signs of resistance or progression, we could target just those sites with the goal of keeping the patient on their cancer medications that are otherwise being shown to be effective at controlling the other spots in their body. How do clinical trials contribute to our treatment options? I'd say this is a very exciting time for radiation-related clinical trials for metastatic prostate cancer patients. We have recent trials that have demonstrated that in newly diagnosed men with only a few metastases in their body, we call them oligometastatic or low-volume metastatic patients, if we treat their prostate alone, so don't even treat their sites of metastatic disease, we can improve their life expectancy and other important endpoints. We're also finding that we can also treat their sites of metastases, so like all known sites of disease in their body, and likely also improve significant outcomes for significantly improve outcomes for patients and reduce the need for other cancer drugs, or at least delay the need for other cancer drugs. I also want to just quickly touch upon something that Dr. Slovin mentioned, which is a really exciting research topic now for us, which is how we can use the injectable forms of radiation, such as the PSMA-tagged radiopharmaceuticals. And this is something that we're looking at to either enhance the effect of other cancer drugs, like, hormone therapy, but also we're looking at it in earlier settings to potentially replace hormone therapy in some patients. And we have multiple ongoing trials like this available at Sloan Kettering that are open and opening. I'll stop there.
Dr. Govitz, that was really a very, very insightful and comprehensive perspective on radiation treatment and all of its different types of treatment. So I know the questions to you also during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell, and Dr. O'Donnell will introduce herself as well.
Thank you so much for the warm welcome. It is my great pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity to talk to you about physical activity, quality of life, and also communication with your healthcare team. One of the questions that's commonly asked by patients are, what are the types of things that I can help myself with? What can I do to help myself as I go through this cancer journey? And I think it's particularly relevant in metastatic prostate cancer, where there are medications that can have significant impact on muscle mass and body composition. And so what we'll talk a little bit about today is just the role of physical activity. First and foremost, that always needs to begin with a discussion with your healthcare provider to make sure that there are not any issues related to your bone or any of your other treatments that might be safety concerns. But beyond that, really the goal in terms of physical activity is to really try to continue to remain active, and that can take on a variety of different forms. Some people may engage in ongoing moderate intensity exercise, which is great, but exercise can be very broadly defined. It is not just the things we think of like running or hopping on a treadmill. It can be dancing. It can be yoga. It can be walking. Even physical activities, things that preserve muscle, like doing gardening or house chores, are really important. And very often when someone's diagnosed with cancer, there's this natural tendency where people try to step in and start to help them do things. And I would actually argue that it's important to maintain your sovereignty to the extent you can. Continue to engage in all of those activities of daily living that you have always done so that you preserve your fitness. It's kind of like use it or lose it. And I think that their physical activity has been shown to improve things like cancer-related fatigue and also can improve mood, anxiety, and depression. So trying to stay physically active can be really important. If there are any questions around physical activity, too, remember physical therapy is a resource that can be prescribed as part of your medical care and covered by your insurance. So these are things to discuss with your healthcare team, so that you have the opportunity to really think about and preserve your optimal fitness as you go through your cancer treatment. And also quality of life is important. Really trying to do things that energize and preserve quality of life and have that as a discussion point with your care team can be really important. You know, one of the topics for today is communication with your healthcare team. And we all know that those visits can be short and condensed, especially if there's something active going on, like if there's a change of therapy or there's a side effect from a therapy. Those can very often consume the focus of the visit, as they should. But some tools and just things to think about when we think of the broad spectrum of types of communication with the healthcare team. First and foremost, if there are things that have gone on, if your appointments are spaced far apart, keep a note of them, especially as we carry around our phones and they all have those little note tabs. If you've had side effects or questions or concerns, jot those down at the time you have them so that you remember them at the time of the appointment and don't leave. We've all had that experience where you walk out the door and you're like, oh, I remember what my question is. So keep track of those. That way you have them during those appointments. But when there are appointments where there is, you know, less that needs to be discussed, there's also a tremendous opportunity to talk about values and other things like quality of life, health, physical activity, nutrition, relationships, and stress. You know, your team really wants to provide you with the most comprehensive care, and the number one way that we can achieve that type of excellence in care is through bidirectional communication. So I just really want to reinforce that your healthcare team cares about you as an entire person and wants to know about that, and encourage you to communicate with your team and bring to your visits not just stuff about the cancer or the treatment, but your other thoughts, concerns, and interests as they pertain to your cancer care. And thank you again for having me. It's been a great privilege to speak with you. Thank you.
Dr. O'Donnell, such an important part of this call when you think about the importance of quality of life and the importance of really maintaining your quality of life and also communicating with your healthcare team any concerns that you may have. And now we're going to take, we're going to do a number of polling questions, and we're going to ask you each to address those questions one at a time, and that will be very helpful to us as we plan our programs going forward into the future, so we will be sure to keep these programs most relevant to meet your needs. And I also would like to thank everybody for their participation today in this program. It's just been amazing, I have to say, this has just been an amazing call. I do want to acknowledge, first of all, that we had a number of international participants, and I just want to mention who they were. So we had a number of participants both in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, but we also had participants from other countries, and I just want to mention those countries, the Bahamas, Canada. We had participants from Japan, from South Africa, Tunisia, and the United Kingdom. And so I just really want to thank everyone for participating in from Taiwan. I'm going to participate everyone in this call today. I think it's in Lithuania as well. I also want to thank sponsors for today's program, Genentech, for their support of the programs today. And I also want to thank that we've also got a supporting grant from Janssen and Janssen Biotech Inc. A grant from Janssen Biotech Inc. And also from Janssen Affairs LLC. I want to thank them for their support of our program today.
And ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question: how reliable is a PSA level as a marker of disease progression?
So I'll take that. So PSA, as everybody knows, is a number that promotes stress and anxiety, hence the term PSA. PSA is a reliable marker. I would say, though, that it's a marker of disease activity. It is not a consistent marker in terms of how much tumor volume you have. So you can have a PSA of 5 and have widespread disease, or you can have a PSA of 500 and have very little. So what it's doing, if we look at trends and we see that a PSA that is rapidly doubling, starting at integers, not necessarily at decimal points, but if we see a PSA starting to double or triple very quickly, usually within 3 to 6 months, it is a harbinger that perhaps your imaging studies will change. It is not a death knell by any stretch of the imagination, but it helps us work as a, in more of a complementary manner. I don't live and breathe by PSAs. I like to look at scans and the PSA and other factors that might be relevant to the patient. Long-winded answer for a short question, but PSA is reliable. Thank you.
Our next question is, where does choline 11 fit into the scan field?
Daniel, you want to take that?
Sure. I would say at most institutions, the 11 choline PET, at least in the United States, since the approval of PSMA PET imaging by the FDA, C11 choline PET has kind of become obsolete. There were multiple studies that looked at C11 choline PET, Exumin PET was another one, FDG PET, and essentially PSMA PET imaging is more sensitive and specific in a lot of the settings that we were using C11 choline PET. So that became the preferred agent for imaging, and is also, and PSMA, you know, as we know, is also being used to tag radio, you know, pharmaceutical therapies as well.
So, Dr. Gorovitz, is it not true that they were using the PET choline maybe likely for evaluating nodal disease, the amount of disease that was in lymph nodes initially, as opposed to
Initially. And that was when we were, you know, still relying mostly on bone scans, like technetium bone scans to evaluate the bone and basically CT scans for soft tissue. PET choline was better than CT scans at looking at the lymph nodes, or helped at least provide additional information about the activity, you know, that might be within those lymph nodes that you're seeing on a CT scan. But again, it's been, you know, replaced by more sensitive and specific imaging, because PET choline wasn't really as specific to prostate cancer, for instance.
Our next question. I have been on ADT for 3 years for my recurrent metastatic cancer. I see my oncologist every 3 months. Should I get an occasional PSMA or other radioisotope PET scan to see if any new mets are developing, even though PSA is not increasing?
Well, it's a loaded question, because if your cancer, to put it mildly, if your cancer was never producing PSMA or never producing PSA, that's very reasonable. But I would say 98 or maybe 99.9% of the time, if your PSA is at less than 0.05 or is steadily decreasing, one does not need to get any imaging. Dr. Gorovitz, how do you feel when you're monitoring your patients after RT?
Yeah, no, I agree. I generally rely on the PSA unless someone has a rare type of prostate cancer where they presented with a kind of high disease burden but a low PSA, and suggest that we can't really rely as much on PSA as a marker. And then in those rare circumstances, I will get some interval imaging after radiation to assess treatment response and screen for new sites. But that, I'd say, is a very rare indication.
I would agree.
Our next question, what are your thoughts on intermittent ADT?
There is a time and a place for every treatment, and there has been tremendous discussion about when and for whom to use intermittent ADT. Many years ago, we started using ADT for the older patient, the people who would go to Florida for 6 months and we wouldn't see them. And every time everybody went to Florida, they wanted to stop their treatment and feel good. And then when they came back home, they said, okay, it's time for me to restart my treatment for my cancer. When people have much more aggressive disease or have a much higher extent of disease, meaning in multiple sites, we really prefer not to. That doesn't mean that we want every patient to be on hormonal therapy for the rest of his life. I think a lot really depends on what we're starting out with. So if somebody's had a cord compression or a very bad disease, a diagnosis, I would be very, very reluctant to discontinue therapy, even if the scan markedly improves, because once we stop the treatment, the cancer is very, very likely to come back. And that's for very aggressive cancers. If somebody has a Gleason 6 cancer and not a very high tumor burden or is having substantial side effects, it is not unreasonable to give a what we often call a treatment holiday. Although I always tell my patients that there's always the risk that when you come off therapy that we could be surprised by rapid return of the PSA or rapid return of the disease. So really, it's really on an individual basis whether or not this is something that is reasonable for a patient to undertake. And there are pros and cons, as mentioned, so that's why you need to really have a good discussion with your medical oncologist and explore the best way of proceeding with an intermittent therapy, and is it really right for you. Dr. Gorovitz, any thoughts?
No, I would just echo what you said. It's all about
yes.
patient selection, and you know, there are patients who are really having a challenging time on hormone therapy with low metastatic burden or lower risk of progression, or like you had mentioned, you know, if there were progression, it's unlikely to be symptomatic. Those patients, I think, you know, it's safe generally to do intermittent ADT or ADT holidays. And then, you know, now that we have better imaging, I have recommended and went on the next, you know, PSA rise, if and when it happens, when someone comes off of ADT, that we do a PSMA PET scan and see if there is any role for metastasis-directed radiation as a way to continue their time off of ADT. Because there are some studies that suggest that patients with just a few sites of recurrence that's detected on sensitive imaging, if we just target those sites, we can actually delay the need for them to go back on hormone therapy significantly. So, you know, I think it depends on the patient, depends on their risks, depends on, you know, their quality of life and goals of care.
Are there treatments or trials using LU-122 or forms of nuclear medicine to treat areas of the body where scans show cancer possibilities that are near vital organs, but the patient is still hormone sensitive?
So there had been a trial, which I think I'm trying to remember was PSMA-4, or there's another one. There has been a clinical trial for patients who were newly diagnosed with metastatic disease that were just waiting for a final readout. But for people who have, I mean, there's no such thing as just giving a little radiation to go to a specific site unless you're doing external beam radiation or proton beam radiation, as Dr. Gorovitz says, in what we call a salvage setting, trying to rescue or improve something that's isolated. Lutetium PSMA is FDA approved. We are using it a little bit earlier based on clinical trial data, and the idea is to use it after chemotherapy. In either a taxane-based chemotherapy such as docetaxel or cabazitaxel. Please keep in mind that it looks like this drug will ultimately perhaps be used before chemotherapy because it does have benefits. But to answer your question directly, all these treatments are systemic, which means they will only go to the areas which express PSMA, which is likely the sites of tumor. The amount of expression of PSMA in the biliary tree, which is the liver or the salivary glands or even certain cells in the brain, is really very modest and has never caused any issues. But the therapy itself goes everywhere where PSMA is expressed.
My husband has recently completed a nuclear medicine treatment. What would be the next course of treatment for him?
That's very hard to know without knowing what the prior therapies were. So if the person has had multiple hormonal therapies and hasn't worked and then had a nuclear treatment, one could do chemotherapy. We could, if you haven't had all of the different androgen receptor signaling inhibitors, then that could be done. Or one certainly should consider very strongly a clinical trial because there are so many new agents out there that may benefit the patient. But unfortunately, I don't know your husband's history, so I really can't give you any particular recommendation at this time. I'm sorry.
Our next question. I will begin my third round of chemo next week after a nice break. How cumulative can I expect the side effects to be going forward?
Well, you said break. I don't know what the break is. Usually if it's standard of care chemotherapy, it's every 3 weeks. I would say that most patients do very well with really very modest increase in their fatigability, which seems to be the major issue. So most people will complain that they're a little bit more tired. Some people find that they have some watery eyes. That seems to get worse with the treatment. But I would say whether you're older or younger, I've never seen anybody really become so debilitated after having 6 cycles of chemo. In fact, most of my patients are able to go to 8 or 10 treatments without any issues. And a lot of patients are able to go to work afterward. So it's not every patient will sustain this cumulative type of effect. But the fatigue is usually acceptable and just a little bit more noticeable. It certainly does not affect activities of daily living. Anybody want to add anything to that? And exercise is very, very important. Maybe our colleague who talked about exercise could be give us some guidelines on this too, because when people are tired, they don't do exercise. So we have to motivate them.
She would very much recommend that you speak to your, that you do get some help from someone who is in physical medicine or someone who can really help you with activity, with physical therapy, and it's really, very important.
Great. Thank you.
And our last question is, what is the difference between microsatellite instability, MSI, and DNA mismatch repair deficiency, DMMR?
I'm trying to figure out the best way to explain that one. Daniel, you want to come up with a little thought there? It's a matter of nuance.
Yeah.
I mean, there are proteins that are. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, you can.
No. You and I are going to sit here for an hour and discuss it. So I guess we just start off with the genomics and what's wrong with different aspects of the genome.
Yeah. So MSI, I mean, just trying to simplify it as much as I can.
I am
MSI
also,
is actually like errors that have been made in DNA replication that can be detected that are commonly happen in tumors, because tumors are and cancer cells are replicating quickly and make mistakes a lot. Someone who has a deficiency in mismatch repair is actually someone who has an inability to fix those errors. So they have different implications. So if you have a lot of errors in your DNA, one of the implications is that you also are producing, so you have MSI, for instance, microsatellite instability. That means that you're probably producing kind of abnormal proteins that can probably be a target for new drugs, especially immunotherapies. So that's one kind of relevant aspect of MSI. The mismatch repair deficiencies, the significance is more of a susceptibility to certain medications as well, but just in a for a different reason, if that makes sense.
I mean, the mismatch repair, there are at least, what is it, four proteins that are involved in good genomic stability. And if all four of these proteins are expressed, it means somebody has what we call proficient mismatch repair, meaning it's normal. But if any one of those proteins is absent, we call that a mismatch repair or mismatch deficient. And we see that a lot in colorectal cancer. So, you know, a lot of what Dr. Gorovitz is trying to convey essentially is that these are genetic alterations that can affect the growth fidelity of the cell. In other words, they may contribute to the cell producing more mutations, and those mutations are then passed on to the next generation of cells. And so it may cause more issues with response to treatment. So I wish we can make this as easy as pie, but unfortunately, it's just a matter of, I think, the degree of the mutations that would discern whether somebody is microsatellite high or has mismatch repair deficiencies. It's just a matter of the extent to which the repair mechanisms that repair the DNA and stop these mutations from occurring can be controlled. I'm sorry we can't make that any simpler.
Yeah, but I think the most, probably for the purposes of this call, the simplest thing to say is that both are markers for potential
response,
immunotherapy response.
Yep.
Thank you so much. With that, I'll ask our speakers to provide some takeaways from today's program. We'll start with you, Dr. Slovin.
Well, lots of things going on. I've already mentioned that we will likely have a new standard of care with androgen deprivation therapy known as darolutamide that's already approved for use in triplet therapy for patients with hormonal sensitive prostate cancer that's metastatic. There are new biomarkers on the cell surface to which we now have imaging and potential treatments. One of them is called DLL3 or delta-like ligand for neuroendocrine prostate cancer, and that there are new radioligand therapies in addition to lutetium PSMA. We now have actinium 225 PSMA. So lots of things that are being built on new standards of care and are likely to be coming into use much more regularly than previously because of their approvals. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Gorovitz?
Yeah, I guess my main takeaways would be that radiation can be used in multiple settings in a patient with prostate cancer, ranging from localized to kind of end stage. The goal of that radiation, though, is quite different. And in relevant to more to this, call, I would say the goal of radiation for metastases is typically for palliation of symptoms, most commonly that being pain, and it's effective at doing that and safe to do, but it's very targeted. And the other indication, which is emerging, and is to use it in patients who are not symptomatic, but we might be able to extend their lives or extend their time on a hormone therapy or delay the time to need systemic therapy using targeted radiation.
Thank you so much. Dr. Messner, anything to add?
Oh, thank you so much. And I would like to actually thank all of our participants today on this amazing call. Although we have done a program like this in the past, it's really never been as incredible as it is today. And it's a credit to both all of our speakers and our participants today that this has been such a remarkable call. The questions were wonderful. The speakers were wonderful. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. And I think it was the participation of both the participants and the speakers that made this program so very wonderful today. Again, I want to remind everyone that this is an important program that we're offering, and that we will probably offer other programs on this topic again. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.